Good evening. Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's program was recorded on Sunday, September 27th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Tonight's program focuses on homelessness. We're going to hear from Evie Craig, who's president and CEO for Restart Inc., which is an organization that works with the Veterans Administration to help alleviate homelessness in Kansas City. We'll follow our usual format tonight. We will hear from Ms. Craig, and then we'll take a short break. We'll owe you some messages at that point, and we'll come back with about 20 minutes of questions from the audience. So without further ado, let's go directly to the introduction of tonight's speaker. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church and our UU Forum. I'm Carolyn McDonald, and I've been a member of the Forum Committee for a long, long time. Now, today our speaker is going to be Evelyn Craig, who is with Restart. Now, whenever we decide at the church, different people get involved with social justice activities. There are some where a certain number of people are involved with this one, and a certain number of people are involved with this one. But with Restart, many, many, many people are involved with that, because once a month there's a turn of sharing a meal. And so Karen Wells is one of the ones who's always been prominently involved with that. And just by coincidence, today is a day that All Souls provides the dinner at Restart. So some of the people right after the forum will be rushing around doing some more cooking kinds of things, getting that all ready. Evelyn, who's our speaker today, is the director of Restart. And I just asked her how long she'd been there, and she said 13 years. And I remember when she became the director, but I never would have guessed it was that many years ago. Somehow time just goes. But she's going to be talking about homelessness in Kansas City, which unfortunately is a problem. And Restart does its best to try to serve, they would like to serve everybody, absolutely everybody, but I think they never turn anyone away from their door, but they're continually having to work to be able to serve all the people that are needed. So she will be speaking for about half an hour, then we'll take up a collection, and then we'll have question and answer period.
Thank you, Carolyn. Good morning. Great, everyone can hear me okay, right? Good, great. I'll try not to modulate one way or the other. And I don't think you'll be disappointed, because I think now we have death by PowerPoint, as they call it. But I don't have a PowerPoint because it didn't make sense since for the radio broadcast. But I do have two handouts that I just brought for those who are interested. I don't think you want to waste, nor do I want to waste yet another piece of paper that I won't keep. But if you're interested, there's an overview, a brochure about restarting our services. And I also have information about something, a community initiative that I'll be talking about at least briefly at the end, which is ballot petition that will be a group of us in the community have been working on for a couple of years. It's called the Children's Services Fund, and I'll be talking about that as well. So if you're interested in more information on that, I have those two things. And if not, that's great. So I just wanted to begin, first of all, by saying thank you, right? I mean, what a coincidence that this is the Sunday that you are doing dinner for us. And I think, in fact, Karen, whom I have to apologize to, because she has been a great facilitator of my getting here this morning, and I've missed almost every deadline she has given me and carousing a mix. So I know she just must be breathing a sigh of relief that I'm here after. I'm like, oh, that's right, you need this bio, you need this. And she's just done a great job of giving me this opportunity. How many of you have served meals at Restart, been part of that? Okay. Well, if you have, and even if you haven't, you're going to want to come back in March for sure, because we are renovating our kitchen and dining room, and they said it could never happen. In fact, we're renovating our entire ground floor. It's taken us a long time to renovate the building, as those of you who've been out of it probably know. We really started major work late 2006 into early 2007. But I'm really pleased that it's taken that long, because it's really let us develop programs as the need evolves and new and best practices happen. So for example, in the ground floor, it won't just be a kitchen and dining room, as important as that is, but it will be a job training center. There's going to be a tech center in that area. And those of you, how many of you were ever in the area that used to be our overnight emergency shelter? If you were ever down there, we'd had our community's most vulnerable citizens in one of our worst places, and that now that all has been changed there in Allde. And that area, I'm so pleased to say, is going to be our tech center, an opportunity. 80% of our food services staff are residents or former residents. 38% of our total 72-member staff are homeless or formerly homeless individuals. It's what we've always done. It's critical to what we do. I'm very pleased that 80% of the workforce in my food services department are residents or former residents. It also happens to be the department in which I have the least amount of turnover. However, they're not making what I'd like to see them making, and they're not getting the promotional opportunities because we're so small. So we're really pleased to be able to take that kitchen and dining room and be able to turn it into sort of a laboratory for folks to be able to move on. So very excited about that. Hey, Karen, I was just thanking you for your patience and facilitation skills and also mentioning that mood. In fact, it's very interesting to me to be here today for a number of reasons, but if you think of what's changed at Restart since we began, which is almost when you began supporting us, which would have been in September of 1981, when Dr. Stuart Whitney opened the doors of Grand Avenue Temple United Methodist Church to men and women who were on the street. And in that day, we were radical in three ways in which I'm proud to say we're still radical today. One, we were the first shelter downtown, or at first shelter really anywhere in the region, to accept women as well as men. Now, Restart was founded, although we're very proud of being really one of the most inclusive service programs in the area, but we were founded by a Methodist minister, a group of concerned clergy and lay people. And I don't know if this is true, so this may be apocryphal, but I've heard it was said that if we let women in, they would only cause trouble. And in fact, we've been causing trouble at Restart ever since. So we're radical in that way. Secondly, we were the first shelter to take in people who were actively under the influence of alcohol or a controlled substance, as long as they were not a threat to themselves or others, feeling very strongly that if you are impaired, judgment is impaired, you are at great risk on the street. And I might say that though occasionally you do see crimes perpetrated by individuals who are, we think, are homeless, by and large, homeless individuals are much more likely to be prey as opposed to victims. And the third way in which we were radical, and we still are today, and I want to point out to you that was 1981. So in 1981, I was a size 2 and had big hair, big shoulder pads, and big earrings. All of which is to say those are days that aren't coming back. So, but in 1981, to take in folks who were HIV positive was a major, major issue in our area and across the country because we were all very ignorant about HIV. There weren't the treatments that there were now, but we're very proud that we were one of the first, if not the first, to do that. Today, through a contract that we have with the health department called HOPA, Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, in any given year, we provide transitional housing and a vast array of services to about 64 to 70 households, including families, where one of the members is HIV positive. We also have been very active and very wanting to make sure that we are, again, as inclusive as possible. We provide services, and particularly residential services, to folks however they identify themselves. So in other words, if you identify yourself as a woman, you are in women residential programs. If you identify yourself as a man, you are in residential programs limited to men. I just make that point because that's not the practice in all services, although more and more folks are moving towards that way. We also take families however they define themselves. So if whatever your partnership is, you are accepted as a family at Restart. So whatever that genders of the two partners, if it is, there's some places that won't take unmarried couples, we certainly take unmarried couples. We take folks who are coming in with their aunties, their grandma, however you are identified as a family. Because I don't know how many of you heard, I'm going to quote the Pope here in a minute, but I don't know how many of you heard the Pope speaking today, but he was speaking about the importance of family and where family is positive, and we couldn't agree more. So, as everybody know, the Pope is here. My birthday was Wednesday, so I'm really glad he came for the party. And you're welcome that I brought him. But you know, as is typical of this Pope. Whichever day it was, he was in D.C. I'm sorry, I'm losing track. But he ate with at a homeless program. And then in a speech later at a church, he said, and I just really want to quote this whole thing. "I want to be clear. We can find no social or moral justification, no justification whatsoever for lack of housing. The Son of God came into this world as a homeless person. The Son of God knew it was like to start life without a roof over his head." Well, I mean, obviously, I'm going to zero in on something that the Pope says about homelessness, but what I really want you to focus on is he focuses on housing. Now, I will tell you why I say that. There's been a major shift that was controversial, still remains with a little controversy in, and I'm sorry to say that there is an industry of homeless services, but there is. There are over 70 providers in this region alone. That's a lot. That's a lot of resources, right? We are called to be responsible with our resources, because any resource that goes somewhere then doesn't go somewhere else, unless I've missed something. So if you look, that's a lot. Not to say it isn't needed, not to say we don't all do a good job, but we're called to look at that. So the shift, the best practice, or at least increasingly accepted as best practice, is something called housing first. I don't know who's heard this phrase, housing first. A couple of you have, great. And it's predicated on the fact that really everybody is housing ready. Well, I'm going to tell you, for most of us who work with homeless individuals, this was a new concept. No, people aren't housing ready. They need to be cured. They need services. They need, well, of course, you know, the counseling. They need all of this before they can possibly be in housing. Well, I'm not saying that a lot of people I serve don't need a lot of services. Some do, some don't. But with all due respect, I look across the audience. Maybe a couple of you could benefit from some services. I could benefit from lifelong case management. But you know what? It's just not resource feasible. So what is? So in housing first, we say, really, basically, everybody's housing ready. And I don't know how many of you, when you were going in to apply for a lease or a mortgage, did anybody ask you, are you housing ready? They said, can you pay this, right? So that's about what they said. My mom asked a couple, really, that's a basic thing they said. Or more importantly, does a bank believe you can pay this, right? So we have for years, frankly, kept people homeless much longer than they needed to be. Why is that a problem? And again, I don't mean to make light of the fact, and we'll talk a little more later, of some of the issues that the people we serve face, but not all of them. And that's also been an issue. We lump everybody into one category and say everybody, one size fits all of services. But that means that children can go for 8 years without housing. In fact, if you look at the waiting list at the Housing Authority that really got impacted under sequestration, you'd have an 8-year-old boy who might be waiting 4 years. That went to 6 or 7. And I said, well, by the time he finally gets housing, if he does for you, he'll have his own family. Now, I'm just here to tell you, 4 years is an eternity for a child. 4 years is an eternity. And to have people in quasi-institutional settings, no matter what you try to do, that is what they are, right, is incredibly impactful in a way that may not be the most positive for the individual and for the community at large if we don't focus on this housing. Housing, your stable housing. You're all under a roof at one time. We have many families that have been scattered for years as a result of trying to get in and out of programs, able to get housing. So we're focusing on housing first, and it's made a huge difference. I mean, you can probably tell what I'm saying, that I believe that very strongly that housing is the foundation of community and personal development. So I can't mention that enough. We were very lucky at Restart to receive a grant and be the local sponsor of an initiative in 2012 through 2014 called 100,000 Homes. I don't know how many people have heard of that. Again, founded on the radical notion that if you're homeless, the one thing you probably need, we know before we've done any assessments, is that you need housing. You don't have a regular fixed nighttime residence. So 100,000 Homes was founded on a principle that it's really started in 2011, but by July of 2014, that across the country, communities would house 100,000 chronically homeless persons. It could be families, it could be adults. It was mostly adults. We accepted responsibility for that here in Kansas City, or coordinating it with a coalition of 20 agencies. I'm happy to say that between October of 2012 and July of 2014, we housed 424 households, including 107 vets. And we saw we can do it. What's the initiative that has evolved since then is called Zero 2016, which is working on federal and local priorities, that is to bring veteran homelessness to what's called functional zero, and we'll talk about that shortly, by the end of this year, and to bring chronic homelessness to functional zero by the end of 2016. Why pick particular populations? I know we want to hear about families, and I certainly will talk about that, and youthing aging out of foster care. It's just in the terms of chronically homeless individuals, that they're people who in and out of the system, it utilizes a lot of resources. Let's stabilize those that are really in the most need. In the terms of vets, I think you can understand there certainly just is a sense that veterans should not be homeless in this country. We need to develop resources for them. And the VA, notwithstanding that there have been many, many issues, has done that and done that, I would say, pretty effectively over the past couple years. And I'm pleased that we're part of that. So that is where we are moving now. And if you have been to Restart off and on, one major change that we made in moving towards housing first was to end the lineup at our overnight emergency shelter. If you had come to Restart in September of 1981, when it was at Grand Avenue Temple United Methodist Church, around 4 o'clock in any weekday afternoon, you would see a lineup of our community's most vulnerable citizens, men and women, young adults who had no business being with folks who'd had a lot going on in their life and were not by any means, in most cases, their best mentors, people with lifelong untreated mental illnesses, people with active substance abuse issues, also untreated, people with physical disabilities, people who are developmentally disabled. They'd line up, as they do at all the shelters, they'd get a ticket. It's a little bit of first come, first serve, unless there's something about it, and you come in, you get a meal, you get a bed, you get breakfast in the morning and you're out. And I'm able to tell you that in most cases as well, things like even your toilet paper is doled out to you by a professional staff of monitors who are there. And unsurprisingly, lots of issues arise with those programs. So for us, we decided that we needed to change this, and the only way we were going to change this was to get persons in a program where the focus could be on working through with them their housing plan. Because as a homeless services agency, we felt that that's probably our central call, to work folks through with their housing plans. So effective November of 2013, we ended the lineup. We have people in all day. If you were at the old program, although the men and women were in separate dorms, they were it was very close. They were on the same floor. We expanded our number of beds for women because that remains a need. So we went from 28 to 42 beds for women, and we decreased slightly our number of beds for men. We went from 58 to 60, depending upon what was going on, down to 48. We did that because programs like City U Mission had expanded their beds for men. Again, it's this issue of looking at what our community needs and not just saying this is how we're going to do it. In the most recently completed year, before we made the change, out of 1,568 persons we served in the old overnight emergency shelter, 4 exited to permanent housing. We are now averaging 8 to 10 a month who exit to permanent housing. It's been truly an amazing thing to watch. But what was very humbling and really let me know that we as service providers bear a great deal of responsibility for what I would say has been a very patriarchal and broken system of services to individuals who are homeless. When we began talking to folks as we were interviewing them, we're making the shift from the old program to the new program and seeing if they wanted to go, and if they didn't, trying to make other arrangements for them. We found that 3 out of 4 had income. They had income. It may not be a lot. It was often disability, SSI, but they had income, and they'd had income for years. And we didn't know it. Because when you have paraprofessional staff and you just see people overnight, you don't really do an assessment. You don't spend much time. You look at their ID, that's about it. Well, why do I sigh? Well, that means that particularly if folks had Medicaid, which is gateway to permanent housing, most of the folks that we were seeing in that program where they lined up every day, where they schlepped their stuff around all day, where everything they did kept them in that state that they were in, could have been housed decades before when we finally did it. It's taken some time. We still occasionally will have somebody when we say we want to sit down and talk with you about your housing plan because they want to talk with us about a free shower, and we say we want to talk with you about your housing plan first. They literally look sometimes as if we said, we're going to take you out in the parking lot and shoot you. I go, no, wait, it's not going to hurt, just as a housing plan. And that's the nature of our agreement. That's our transaction. We're going to talk with you about how we're going to do all the other stuff, but that's what we want to focus on. We've also entered into a partnership because we knew we had folks with a lot of needs in that particular program. About 80% have a mental health diagnosis, some pretty severe. So we entered into a partnership with Truman Behavioral Health. We're able to have one qualified mental health professional from their team with us that's able to get people hooked up with whatever they need for meds and docs. And it really has just been a remarkable program. Now, it's not without bumps, as everything is in this field. When we first made the change, I was glad after 2 weeks when I found the empty plastic vodka bottle outside the building as opposed to inside. I thought, that's a mark of respect. We're getting somewhere. And I'll tell you the truth, you know, serving folks with who have been what they call high flyers in the system. We had one young woman who in a 90-day period had 42 interventions with emergency services that we as taxpayers paid for, from ambulance to police to a number of things. In her first 6 months with us, she had 2. But she was a lot of work. She was disruptive, but so she should be due to her diagnosis and the fact that no one had really done anything about it consistently over the years. I'm trying to keep my eye on time because I'm spending more on this than I meant to. So anyway, we are all housing ready. So we're moving much more. Our first permanent housing program, A New Start, which is in Midtown, opened in February of 2006. February 13, to be exact. And I remember being ecstatic that we had our first permanent housing program. At that point, then, in 2006, 1% of Restart's annual operating budget was dedicated to permanent housing. I say that because this is so duh, right? That we serve homeless people, and 1% of our budget was dedicated to permanent housing. In 2015, this year, 48% of our budget is dedicated to permanent housing. And I would say that we are right-sizing. What kind of permanent housing programs do we have now? We have 2 that are called facility-based, which means we operate through a master lease all of the units in one building, and we have staff in there. We also do scattered sites. I always love, and Karen and Walter have been with me in a couple of meetings where folks were obviously less than pleased to have us in their neighborhood, and sometimes we've been able to go ahead and work it out, and other times we've said, you know what, this level of hostility, I'm not sure that I want people that I serve to live by you, thank you very much, and we've moved. But I'm often sitting in places where, in neighborhood meetings, where people will talk about, you know, us bringing people in, and I just want to say, through scattered sites, I got about 18 of my people right around you right now, and so far, everything seems fine. So that's the plus for scattered sites. It's just normal living, and we're able, through HUD grants, other means to support their housing long-term if they have a disability, or through what's called rapid rehousing to help pay their rent, pay it all if needed, and then kind of ease it off so that you don't fall off a cliff for as long as a year or even longer than that. That's made a huge difference, including for young adults. We are about to open in 1 month one of the first programs in this region, one of the first nationwide, of permanent housing for youth that have aged out of foster care. It's 14 units. It's our first construction in Waldo. We're in Waldo because five other neighborhood associations closer to Troost, where we had an optional, decided they didn't want us there. And you know, I love Waldo, and if I were 18 to 26, which these young people would be, I would be saying thank you very much. We lost a year in development, but we got it together, and it is amazing. Why are we excited about that? I mean, youth in foster care are among the fastest growing segment of the homeless population, and I don't often stand in places in Missouri and talk about where we are progressive, but we are progressive, and you can opt as a state to keep kids in foster care through the age of 21. We do that, which is great. However, we still don't do any preparation for folks as they get ready to go, which is amazing. You know, all along, they're going to go, so nothing changes in that last 18 to 12 months. No further preparation for what's going to go on. And again, we see lots of kids who've been not in foster care for a long time, but in and out of it. And I would say to you, having worked with Children Protective Services in five states, one of the shames of this nation is our child protective services system. It is bad, and it is bad everywhere. And there's lots of reasons why that's the case. So I'm not disparaging the folks who work there or the folks who run it. There's lots of reasons why that's the case. But if we don't at some point get our arms around that as a nation, we're going to be dealing with generations and generations of difficulties. But part of what happens, and you can see it, is that low-income and minority kids are disproportionately taken out of their parents' custody, and that just sets up this cycle of inability to be stable, and these kids bear the brunt of that. So we're very excited about that. We're working with providers around the neighborhood, around the community, to make sure that more of these are developed. At the end of 2014, there were, I hope I have this number right, more than 800 kids who were aged out of foster care in Jackson County. There are just a few over 300 approved foster households. So that kind of tells you there what's up. I will share with you, we're now in the process of enrolling folks, and one young man that we've enrolled, it's two stories, but without an elevator, so one young man that we've enrolled asked for a place on the ground floor, and we asked why, and he said because he wants his grandma to be able to come visit him, and she can't get up the stairs very easily, and he said, you know, would it be okay if she ever spent the night? We said, sure, it's your place. You know, if you have any income, you'll be paying 30% of that towards us. It's your home. You make the rules, as long as the rules you're making aren't hurting others. And he said, no, I'll want to stay just once or twice. I know I have to learn to be by myself, to live by myself, that she can't continue to raise me. So again, I'm very excited. We broke ground, I say we as if I did, the contractors broke ground 2 weeks ago at the corner of Admiral and Troost. We'll be constructing Rose Hill Townhomes. That's 33 units of permanent supportive housing for homeless families. Very excited about that. When we did the focus group to kind of get a sense of what people wanted as designs, again, very humbling, who were excited to have things like this. Private front and back entrances. Laundry, washers and dryers in their units. An open kind of floor plan so that if a mom or dad or whoever it is in the kitchen preparing dinner, which, you know, you feel like you spend feel like I've spent generations doing that. You can look around and see what's happening. Where we have 10 three-bedroom units, and accommodations for large families are really at a critical point in our community. We have 10 three-bedroom apartments, and we made the bedrooms slightly smaller because what a lot of our families said about three-bedroom apartments is there's no common area. There's the three bedrooms and a kitchen, and there's really not a lot of place. So we're able to carve out a living room. We're going to have the parking lot's going to be gated, and then to just see how people felt about this was really, again, very humbling to me because I go home to Lenexa, and my environment is pleasing. It is soothing. It is safe. And I will tell you, as excited as I am about the housing we're providing for people, some of it isn't at the quality that it should be, and some of it is in neighborhoods that I'm concerned about. And, you know, every kids don't get to pick their zip code, so every zip code should be safe, should have quality schools, and should have great amenities. And we know that that isn't the case. And then what do we expect? So why am I talking about family? I'm talking now about family units. Excuse me. And I've been focused on more of adults, and I want to come back to another principle around housing first. But I do want you to know that I am concerned. I mean, it's a great concern, and we are, again, there are plans in the way in terms of how services are developed, and it's a long ways off to be able to end or bring family homelessness to functional zero, and it could be as late as 2020 because it gets very complicated. Why does it get so complicated? Well, here's one big reason. Kansas City is in the top 10 major metropolitan areas for family evictions. Every day, 19 families are formally evicted in Kansas City. I say formally evicted because that doesn't count those where they just leave because they know they're about to get kicked out, or where a landlord says, I'm going to give you $200 if you and your kids get out of here. Now, why is that a concern? Very quickly, and you're probably already there. So the family is evicted. There's an eviction on your record. Go to a shelter for a short period of time. Increasingly, the only kind of housing they can get is substandard because they have an eviction on their record. And we are looking increasingly at the impact on kids developmentally, but 0 to 5 of being in substandard housing, the health impacts are incredible. What we see with older kids, of course, the educational impact is, again, very, very difficult. Then they're paying more than 30% of their income for rent. So what happens? Life happens. Something happens in the family, a car repair, if they're lucky enough to have one, and then what happens next? Well, they're evicted again. Their job, they're evicted again. And what we're doing is working with some of our youth that we have in our youth transitional program, which is 21 months for youth 17 to 22, is to put aside some funding in a savings account, and we call it your eviction prevention fund, so that if you lose your job, I mean, a lot of them are fast food, and it could happen through no fault of their own, pay your rent. Again, because we've seen folks who have been extended families, someone's had a lot of evictions. From the perspective of a kid, it seems like still they're fine. They don't know all the pressures that's going on. So they feel that eviction is not a problem. We say, for God's sake, do not have an eviction on your record at 19 or 20 already. It will haunt you for a decade. For a decade. And please don't do that. All right. So I've been tossing all those around. I'm going to go back very briefly, because we're at that point, to another critical principle in Housing First that we used in 100,000 homes, and that is prioritization and centralized intake, not taking first come, first serve. And I'm sure, you know, why is that? It's hard anytime you get a phone call. What can you do? But the reality is we're moving towards, again, housing chronic and targeting populations. Excuse me, based on morbidity. We really want to get people into housing before they die. And we use a tool called the SPDAT, the Service Prioritization Assistant Decision Tool, and I'm sorry I had to do that. It was developed, though, as basically, first it was called the VI, the Vulnerability Index. And when we go out on the point in time count, and I would invite you if you want to, we're looking for folks on January 27th and 28th of 2016. When we go out on that, when we are assessing people when they come in, it really registers sort of your trimorbidity. And the overall scores that we keep on a by name registry list of the people who've had this rank from 1 to 10. And 6 to 10, we know you are chronic, you need permanent supportive housing, generally speaking, unless something changes, at least for the short term. And then below, you would be able to function in a rapid rehousing program. Why is it important to do that? Because not everybody needs the services that we end up putting them in, some of which are incredibly resource intensive and they don't need. I'll give you an example. I was coming back on a plane, so reading some reports, and in 1 year, in our two family transitional housing programs, we had served 88 families. Of those 88, 56 came from living with family or friends. And then when I went on, I read, we didn't have people who were very sick. Well, that's a good thing. But I'm saying transitional housing is about the most expensive model. So why did these folks who weren't street or shelter homeless, who didn't have high levels of mental illness, disabilities, substance abuse, what happened? So I said to my staff, which is part of the model that's going with this, did we think of those 56 who came from living with family and friends, we think to call and say, what would it take for you to be able to stay there maybe 60, 90 more days while we get you housing? Help to pay groceries? Help with some utilities? I'm not saying that it's easy to live with a family member, you know, after they're adults. I call it the summer with Aaron, where our son lived with us. We're still talking. So I'm not saying it's easy. But how many people did I have to turn away who were street or shelter homeless, who were living in their cars, who were in abandoned buildings, because I took folks in, 56 to be exact, out of 88 that had other options. So I can see that as on the awards show, the music is about to play, and I'm sorry, I kind of moved around a lot, but I wanted, because you're sophisticated folks who've been with us for a long time, I wanted you to hear sort of what are some of these new practices in the field, and then to give you a chance to ask some questions. So thank you. And I'll see those of you who are there tonight. I'll see you tonight.
This is the All Souls Forum. You're listening to Evie Craig, president of Restart here in Kansas City, talking about the homelessness situation. We owe you some messages. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back after these with questions from the audience for Ms. Craig.
Thank you. I spend a lot of time trying to get people who have access to resources to be aware of stories like the one you just told, which is tremendous. I guess my question this morning is, what have you been able to do in the way of using social media or other pathways to sort of broaden the reach, and can you tell whether people are listening out there, or is it kind of still in the one-way mode?
Well, I'm of a certain generation, so I'm relatively unsophisticated in social media, but it is used a lot by programs. I think everybody has a Facebook page. People are tweeting. Whether we're doing it in a way that's strategic and is reaching folks is another matter, and I think most places are grappling with that. But there are a lot of national organizations that are spearheading many of these movements. And if anyone who is on Facebook, and I don't do Twitter very often, but if you're on Facebook, you will see there at least is a lot more information that's been able to be shared about homeless vets, about less, I'm sorry to say, we need to do more about homeless kids, although there's been some great stuff on the foster care system. So I don't have a specific answer. We're all using that. But I would certainly say that it gives you that ability to for free get your message out, right? And that's critical. So it's incumbent upon those of us to do stuff with our social media, which we don't very often. We are very good at asking for toothbrushes, at asking for cleaning supplies. We're not so good about asking for changes in the system. And that we need to do. So thank you. You remind me of that. I just have to mention two other things because I didn't get a chance to get it in. Family homelessness, I want you guys to think about this. So I'm not a social scientist, so I can only say there's a chronological link, not a causal link. But you all probably knew this, that welfare reform I do this, that lets you know what I think about it. It was passed in 1997, first enacted really, I think, in 1998. So in 1998, we served 7 families. Last year, I'm going to have to double check it, it was just under altogether over 350 families. More than 10,000 of the people that we serve, the 23,000 people we served, and we do use an HMIS, a homeless management information system, so we know we're not using duplicate numbers, were children and youth. And it's directly relative, in my opinion, to what happened in 2000, because one other thing, you know that the horse trade that was made between the Clinton administration, with all due respect, and the Republican lawmakers was 3 strikes and you're out. So when you combine the lack of, you know, when there's all kinds of problems with the old AFDC, those of you who are really old, right? Aid to Families with Dependent Children. But if you had a child, you had some resources and you weren't homeless. You could pay rent. I'm not saying you didn't have other problems, but you could pay rent. Your kids stayed in one school, right? That's not what happens now. A young woman in one of our returning grand homes who from kindergarten to 12th grade was in 13 different schools, and she said she realized that she moved all the time because her mom couldn't pay bills. And I thought, you know what, when I was a kid, I didn't know what bills were. So the combination of welfare reform and incarceration certainly has impacted in more, well, I think we all know what's happening with the correctional system, but with more mothers being jailed than ever before has really, really take an incredible impact on the future generation. So I'm sorry, I'm going to let you talk.
Well, I was going to ask a question somewhat along what you just said. I was wondering what kind of support you get from the city and the state, and do you have any program to try to change these draconian laws that have caused so much damage?
We get a lot. A lot of our funding is governmental, which means it comes from everywhere and means it's also sometimes very interesting, but it all works out. But what are we doing? Well, I just talked about Missouri not being progressive, and now in yet another public forum, I'm coming back to this family eviction issue, I'm going to say Kansas is more progressive than we are in this area. Making sure nothing happens to me, but it's true. And that is, we have draconian landlord-tenant laws in the state of Missouri, and that's largely because, just as happened with the payday loans, because of legislators who are landlords are passing legislation to their benefit. Now that we can change. And in St. Louis, I'm going to have this wrong because, one, I'm not a lawyer, and two, the only Latin I remember is amoa mas amant, amamus amantis amant. I only wanted to know about love when I was learning Latin. So it's de novo or something. It's a thing that their municipal judges in St. Louis have done that gives provides for 30-day notice for eviction. So I'm not saying that sometimes people aren't evicted for the right reasons, but I'm saying let those of us who have programs that can either stabilize our housing, keep them there, and provide services to them that they need to stay stable, or that have rapid rehousing so we can, give us the time to get in. Because we're all paying for that. I mean, if our only response on that, and there's nothing wrong with your response being based on public resources, because, you know, public resources are something we should be responsible about. So if we have public resources that can help them, but by shifting them out, you're putting them into programs dependent upon public resources, let us get the right public resources to them. So we're hoping, I've been talking with some folks in the mayor's office, hoping to be able to get the municipal judges here in Kansas City to agree to that. It would make a huge difference. I mean, that 19 a day stunned me. I was at a conference in D.C., and there were just 2 of us from Missouri. This guy from Harvard was doing this great presentation. I was really focused on the fact that I was, frankly, at the end of this day, it was a Sunday in February, last Sunday in February, I was going to get my nails done. I was mostly focused on that. So I was kind of floating off at the end of a couple of PowerPoints. And then they showed this incredible video, this incredible presentation on a family in Milwaukee that had been evicted. And, you know, I'm thinking, God, this is so and whatever, and it's a great presentation, but it's Milwaukee. So he starts rattling off the top 10 municipalities. And I'm thinking, I'm hearing Baltimore, I'm hearing this, I'm hearing that. And he goes, Kansas City. So in addition to being, you know, obsessed with my nails and distracted by that, I also went, oh my God, what does my name tag say? I hope it just says Evie Craig, Restart Missouri. But no, of course it said Evie Craig, Kansas City, Missouri. So I caught him afterwards and talked about it. We tried to bring him in for a conference in November. Things didn't work. We're hoping to bring him in next year, but we're at least able to work with some folks at Legal Aid and get this analysis, because he reached out to me and said, why is Kansas eviction rate so much better than yours? And I said, I don't know, let's find out. So we are working to try to find, that's one thing, but you know what, that'll be huge.
Okay, the first is sort of irrelevant, that vacant lot on Troost. We were wanting the kids to be living there. It's still a vacant lot, and the neighborhood is still saying, we ought to do something about that. But anyway.
We had an example. You can see neighborhoods sinking to the lowest common denominator, truthfully.
Oh, yeah.
And in Waldo, we saw it rising to the highest common denominator.
There was,
it
only
was really
one bad letter.
Great
anyway,
to watch. It was great to watch.
Anyway, I do have a question. There, you mentioned the number of agencies that deal with homelessness and chronic illness, etc. How are they working together? I know Restart will take anybody with any religion and not insist. I've worked with a couple of other agencies who want you to profess your belief in Christ before they will feed you. Right. How do you work with all of the different kinds of agencies, and where are the problems?
Well, in fairness to faith-based organizations, which provide basic services that a lot of other agencies don't, it isn't that you have a religious test to get services, it's just that you must participate. You were forced to participate in a denominational service, and it's almost always Christian, as part of the program. And that we just don't do, which is much more comfortable for some folks than others. We do all work together. There's a continuum of care where we meet monthly. There's the regional homeless task force, and we're moving. And I don't want to sound too wonky, so I've already sounded wonky enough. So, and all of this housing first, that everybody's employment. I might say we're getting there with employment as well. That everybody's employment ready. There have been amazing job creation opportunities in some smaller communities in Missouri. For example, and this is a job. We didn't create this job. This is a job. But we have some folks. Some of whom have, you know, severe mental illnesses, but they like to work early, they like to work by themselves, they like repetitive jobs. So they go to McDonald's and put together the condiment packets. It's not a made-up job, it's a real job that existed. But we're like, it's perfect. Since 2010, we've provided the grounds crews for all four of the job centers for MoDOT in Jackson County. So in any given year, we can have about 30 people full-time employed. It's seasonal, it's minimum wage, but full-time employed. This year, you probably know that MoDOT lost some funding, didn't get a ballot initiative, so it was a little smaller, and not for that period of time, but we still had two people who were hired by MoDOT full-time, which is amazing, because you work for the state. It's a great, great opportunity. We used that model. It was based on some job coaching models that were developed for vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, because the preponderance of brain injuries, some of the old notions of job coaches where, you know, you went to visit someone. I mean, just where people have to be able to, they have to have it on site because they can't process conflict very well. It has to be immediate. They can't, you know, and this is a, I can't wait, for God's sake, for 2 hours to resolve a conflict. So it's been great. The MoDOT folks, if you've ever seen them, they look like ZZ Top. So they don't intimidate our folks. They pick them up at one center. We provide transportation for the other. Transportation's provided. You don't have to dress up. We buy the shoes, the jeans, all that stuff. They're with their peers, and the supervisors are right there. So conflicts are dealt with on the spot and well, and it's been great. And they really think the people we've sent to them work very hard, which is why routinely anywhere from 2 to 3 get employed full time at the state. I guess I've said that 1,000 times, right? But that's amazing. And we'd like to do more of that. We have not in this community, they have in other communities, been, in my opinion, and I'm going to, now somebody's going to tell me a program I missed, and I certainly have, we've not done as well in vet employment opportunities, and that's too bad. I mean, we're focusing on housing, and this, you know, year-end deadline is making everybody a little nuts, but There have been opportunities and we've missed them, so we need to come back to that. For a lot of the folks that I work with have had jobs, like they have incomes. They just don't hold them. One of our MoDOT workers this year who got told to seek other employment opportunities was mad because he had, in his words, an all-lady crew besides him. Well, obviously, you know, it's a good thing I'm not the employment specialist at Restart because I would have been like that. And then, you know, our employment specialist went and got him, and so he threw a piece of equipment that belonged to the state against something because he was mad that he was in an all-lady crew. You know, there were immediate consequences. Just said, you can't, you're gone, you're out. And my employment specialist, who has two daughters, could hardly contain himself. I just said, Jonathan, you're going to have to calm down between now and when you go pick this guy up because you're pretty angry. But anyway, I think he's been told, you know, you could work with ladies too. And ladies don't like it when you throw state equipment around. Dude.
So I have a particular interest in hospice services for the underserved. If I'm homeless in Kansas City and I'm diagnosed with a terminal disease, where do I go to die?
Well, let me point out the one bright spot, and that is wonderful hospice for individuals who are HIV positive. And that is fantastic. But none for others. So we have people who die of natural causes all the time in our program. And there just isn't enough. So I don't know what to say. I'm going to just say something. But I want to say I'm so glad you asked that question. Oh, that's not my paper. Because that's something to think about. They don't die with dignity. And the average, and that's why one reason to end this thing of chronic homeless folks just need a cot and it makes me feel good to give them a meal and throw some free clothes at them. And I'm just like, I understand, it's all great, it's all good, is the average lifespan of a chronically homeless person is about 57, which is like, what, 20 to 25 years less than the rest of us. And literally, I don't want to be melodramatic, is we are still too frequently getting people in housing just in time to die. The second individual we housed through 100,000 homes in our community died of renal failure 2 weeks after he was in housing. I had a young man in one of our permanent supportive housing programs who committed suicide 2 days before his 30th birthday. He had just reconciled with his father and his stepmother this fall, 2 days before a significant birthday. They were devastated, but for some folks who with depression, it feels like, I'm sure he felt like, my life isn't going to be this good. I can't sustain this. Fall, significant birthdays. And unfortunately, our residential counselor at that program is himself, has a mental health diagnosis. So when he went into the unit, he could, and I'm sad that he has to know this, know that it was suicide because of the ritualistic setup as opposed to just an overdose. So what are we going to take from that? When we have these units for the kids, I got to quit calling them kids. They'll be very angry with me if I do, for these young adults. We don't want to overwhelm people with services, right? There's something like, hi, we know you have a problem, we're going to help you. I mean, that's just the worst thing you could do, and I believe it because I've done it, is let's work in appropriate kinds of services. So let's make sure, because we have cameras and people around, it's a small place, let's try to have a visual on somebody every 24 hours. Particularly if we're not the struggling. Let's do that. We don't need to burst into their apartment saying, you're capable of taking care of yourself, but do that. Let's make sure we offer the opportunity for birthdays, for celebrations. We have a community room. And be aware particularly of significant birthdays. So like everybody, we learn from those tragedies. But yeah, it's not, yeah. We don't have that. That is something, a huge need. We don't have people beginning and ending their lives with dignity in our country. And you can believe, in most cases, those are the same people. If you began it without it, you're probably going to end it without it.
I'm Pat Knorrier. And
I see you everywhere, Pat, by the way. Which means I'm in all the right places.
You mentioned finding housing for large families. Yeah. Where I live, in the old Hyde Park neighborhood, those houses were all built for large families. So is there any way we can make a match there instead of cutting up those old houses into...
Well, I would say, to be honest, and it's a matter of record, so I'm not outing anybody, that five neighborhood associations, including both, well, there's two
I'm
in Hyde Park.
I can't
okay.
understand.
Oh,
you.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Wait. Just if you talk a little more slowly.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, I will answer now, and I'll try to be more slow. just to speak about that particular neighborhood, let me just tell you that when we try to have the 14 units for our youth, it was Hyde Park, North Hyde Park, we weren't even in their neighborhood, that made it, that took care of the fact that we would not be able to do that. So it's going to be difficult with those neighborhood associations. Now, but it's happening slowly, so it won't satisfy all of us. But in some cases where there have been a couple of houses, some in the northeast that I've seen, some a little on the east side, that were either lost through default on mortgages or abandonment, they're being rehabbed, given to programs like Sheffield Place, and we are seeing families move into larger homes. So it's starting to happen, not systematically. But one thing that we're doing in order to provide affordable rents for folks too is to try to find landlords who will do what's called home sharing. So if you have a three-bedroom apartment or a two-bedroom apartment, will you write two leases? So that way two vets can be housed and their rent can go from $800 to $400, and the support that I'm giving them for you to help pay their rent, they'll be able to sustain it afterwards. So house sharing is a big thing we're looking at. We're also working with realtors to help us find housing for sex offenders. Which is becoming very difficult to find places because of laws and how everybody defines this, the yards around it, around parks and schools and any number of other places where children might be. So we're trying to find places for them because that's a lot of folks who are lingering in shelters because we're just not able to find housing for them.
Thank you.
The other issue I might say, so we got to think about this. It's always easy for us to say, why don't we get people in these large homes? Operating those large houses is very expensive, which is why we look for housing. And I will tell you, you've not done anyone a favor if you get them in a place, even if you get them in there for free, if sustaining it thereafter is very difficult and beyond their means. Because we have many folks, and I think it would shock most people to know, how many families are homeless. Not only we looked at the high eviction rates, but because they had difficulty paying their utilities. And while the shareholders at, you know, CPNL make a profit off fees, off reset, it's just ridiculous. That spirals down. And I spend thousands and thousands of dollars. I should add it up because it's got to be over $100,000, more than that, every year to pay off the utilities so people can get back into housing. That's another area of reform. We really need to, that's a huge area of reform we need to do in the state with the Missouri Public Service Commission. And I think the music is playing again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Evelyn Craig, who's president and CEO of Restart here in Kansas City, talking about the extensive and growing programs that help alleviate homelessness here in Kansas City. This program was recorded on Sunday, September 27th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. The theme music is composed and performed by local Kansas City musician Fred Potter. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls each week who help us produce this program for you here on KKFI. We hope you'll join us again next Wednesday, same time, same place, for another All Souls Forum right here on 90.1 KKFI.